Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Hello and welcome to Reality Check. Today is Monday, the 12th of April, 2010, and I'm your host, Tony Pittman. And this is episode 32 of Reality Check here on Joy 94.9. Reality Check is a show designed to give you a healthy dose of reality. And we do that by promoting the art of critical thinking and skeptical analysis. Each week we bring you a roundup of LGBT news, followed by an in-depth analysis of an issue related to the paranormal or the pseudoscientific. And finally, we wrap up each show with a movie review. On today's show, after our LGBT news roundup, we're going to begin an examination of an ancient and widely followed form of pseudoscience, astrology. Can the positions of the planets really influence not only your personality traits, but also the events that occur during your life? Well, that's what we'll try to find out. Then in our movie review, we'll have a look at two new films from Europe, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and Welcome. One of those is definitely worth checking out, the other one, not so much. To find out which one is which, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9. Now, before we get into this week's LGBT news roundup, I'd just like to send out a very big thank you to Sonia Suter and to her special guest, skeptic Jason Ball, for covering for me and hosting Reality Check for the last 3 weeks. They did a truly fantastic job, and what I might try to do over the next couple of weeks is put together a podcast version of the highlights of their shows so our podcast listeners don't miss out. So check on the website, realitycheckonline.net, and hopefully that podcast will be up there soon. And as for what I've been doing all this time, well, I was in Indonesia, actually. And I would like to tell you that I went for some glamorous and exciting Reality Check assignment, but actually I went as a dental tourist. Yes, I went to Bali for a root canal. And it actually worked out cheaper to fly to Bali, stay in a hotel and get the root canal done, and have a fantastic holiday, than it would have been to get the root canal done here in Melbourne. So if you've been quoted some hideous price to get some dental work done here, well, I can highly recommend flying off to Bali to get it done over there. And, well, Bali is one of the most fantastic places on earth, so I readily jump at any excuse for a trip over there. Anyway, enough about me and my overseas dental adventures. Let's get into our LGBT news roundup for the last... Well, for the last month, basically, during which quite a lot happened, so I'll try to briefly cover most of the highlights. First, let's look at marriage news, and once again, let's start with the roller coaster ride that is the fight for marriage equality in Argentina. Now, we've been covering the ups and downs of this struggle for over 5 months now here on Reality Check. And today I'm happy to report some good news. Just 3 days ago, on Friday, April the 9th, the third same-sex marriage in the history of Argentina took place. And it was also the first marriage in Argentina between two women. Norma Arévalo and Ramona Castillo tied the knot in a Buenos Aires registry office after receiving a court order requiring the registry office to marry them. They are both 67 years old and have been together 30 years, some of that time spent in exile during the military dictatorship in Argentina from 1976 to 83. So just to recap the situation there, Argentina now has had three legal same-sex marriages. The first took place in December, and those two guys are still officially married. The second took place in March, and their marriage was unfortunately annulled several days later by a court. And the third marriage is the one between Norma and Ramona that just took place on Friday. Let's hope that their marriage is not annulled and that the Argentinian Congress gets off its butt and passes a marriage equality law very soon. Because frankly, this situation is becoming ridiculous. And quite simply, Reality Check listeners cannot go on like this, living every week on tenterhooks, wondering what's going to happen. And at the moment, it's all depending on arbitrary court decisions. So we say to the President of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, get your Congress in line and get this bill passed. Now, you don't want a mob of angry Reality Check listeners breaking down the doors of the Pink House, do you? And yes, dear listener, just in case you're wondering, the office of the President of Argentina is officially known as the Casa Rosada, or the Pink House. Now, continuing with marriage news, let's head to Portugal, where plans to introduce same-sex marriage keep moving forward smoothly. A bill to allow same-sex marriage there was approved back in February. It then passed to the conservative Portuguese president for his signature or veto. He ummed and ahed for a while, then on March 13th sent it to the Constitutional Court just to make sure that it wasn't violating any part of the Constitution. Well, last Thursday, April 8th, the Constitutional Court gave it back to the President, saying that everything was okay and it was all in line with the Portuguese Constitution. So the President now has 20 days to sign or veto the bill. Hopefully he'll sign it, but even if he doesn't, there are enough votes in the Parliament to override any veto. So it looks like whatever happens, we should be seeing the first same-sex marriages performed in Portugal within weeks. Very exciting. And our final piece of marriage news, let's head to the North Atlantic, where Iceland is also making good progress on this front. The government introduced a marriage equality bill to the parliament there on March 23rd, and it's looking highly likely that the bill will be approved, which means we could be seeing the first same-sex marriages there by the end of June. So, a very positive development. And, of course, I should mention that Iceland is the first and only country to have an openly lesbian prime minister. So, I'm sure she's been a helpful force in moving this bill forward. Now, let's look quickly at other LGBT news for the last few weeks. Well, there is some news from Malawi, where we've been following the trial of Stephen Mongeza and Tiwonge Chimbalanga, who have been detained there since December for holding a traditional engagement ceremony. The judge in their case announced on March 22nd that there is a case to answer and the proceedings should now advance to a full trial to be held sometime in April. Now, I'd actually thought that they had been having a full trial already, but apparently that's not the case. The prosecution had been presenting its case, and now apparently the defense will have the chance to present its arguments. The judge has now set the 18th of May as the day he will make his final ruling. This case continues to attract growing criticism from around the world, but the prosecution is continuing, and most worryingly, the two men, Stephen and Tewonge, continue to be held under harsh prison conditions while all this is going on. A really very grim situation there in Malawi. And let's turn now to another piece of grim news. Unfortunately, this time from the country where I was over these last few weeks, Indonesia. And the news is that the International Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Trans and Intersex Association, otherwise known as ILGA, had been planning to hold its Asian Regional Conference in Surabaya in East Java, Indonesia's second largest city, over the weekend of March 26 to 28. But unfortunately, in the days leading up to the conference, a number of fundamentalist Muslim groups began issuing angry proclamations, and hundreds of protesters rallied outside the Surabaya City Council demanding the conference be stopped. Unfortunately, the local police caved in to this pressure and ordered the conference organizers to cancel the whole event to supposedly protect public order and prevent what they called a social crisis. Now, over 150 delegates from 16 countries were scheduled to attend, and of course, at that point, most of them had either arrived at the hotel or were already on their way. So even though the conference had been officially cancelled, they were all there, and they decided to just hold some informal talks in the hotel on March 26th. But what happened next meant that they weren't even able to do that. A mob of Muslim fundamentalists invaded the hotel to try to find the delegates and chase them out of the premises. Luckily, all the conference participants were safely evacuated from the hotel. Now, following this debacle, the Surabaya police did come under quite a lot of criticism from within Indonesia for yielding to fundamentalist pressure and closing down the conference, but by then it was, of course, too late. So here we have, unfortunately, yet another example of how intolerance arising out of religious beliefs violates people's rights and even threatens their physical safety. It's extremely frustrating. Now, I should mention as an aside that I almost went to that conference in Surabaya. I attended the ILGA World Conference in Manila back in 2003 and had a fantastic time. And when I read about this conference and knowing that I was going to be in Bali anyway, which is just a short hop away from Surabaya, I seriously thought about attending. The only reason I didn't go in the end was because I wasn't sure what would be happening with my tooth and whether I might need a dental appointment during those days. So I decided not to go. And, well, of course, now I'm very glad I made that decision because it must have been a very frustrating and indeed frightening experience for the people who did go. Now, finally, I can't finish this wrap-up of the last month's LGBT news without briefly mentioning the two big coming-outs of two big-name celebrities, one of whom is particularly important to the worldwide skeptical community. And I'm talking, of course, about Ricky Martin and James Randi. Both of them quite surprising to me, I must say, but both of them very positive moves, I think. Now, Ricky Martin's was obviously the most high profile of the two and really pretty groundbreaking, I reckon, because he is such a major international star. I mean, he's known pretty much all over the world and has a huge following across the whole community, including heterosexual men. I mean, he sang the anthem for the Football World Cup in France back in 1998. So I think his coming out will have hugely positive repercussions, particularly in Latin America, of course, where he's a massive star, but also in the rest of the world, where he's well-known and well-liked. And I think it's particularly relevant that he's not pudgy and middle-aged or flamboyant and effeminate. He's an attractive, sexy, successful, masculine guy whom a lot of people admire and relate to. And that fact is going to help to break down a lot of stereotypes, particularly in parts of the world where people have a very limited and tainted understanding of homosexuality, such as large parts of Africa and Asia. So a hugely positive development in my opinion. And as for James Randi, well, for people who don't know who he is, James Randi is probably the most famous skeptic in the world. Well, Richard Dawkins is pretty famous, but he's probably better known as an atheist, whereas James Randi is better known as a true skeptic. He's been promoting critical thinking for decades now and has taken on some of the biggest frauds and charlatans out there, such as Uri Geller and Sylvia Brown. And also one case we mentioned here on Reality Check just a few weeks ago, the French homeopath Jacques Benveniste. Randi is probably most famous for his $1 million challenge. To anyone who can demonstrate evidence under test conditions to support a paranormal or pseudoscientific claim, he will give them $1 million. This has been an incredibly useful tool for skeptics in calling the bluff of a lot of proponents of wacko beliefs out there. And here in Australia, Randi is probably best known for causing Don Lane to have a hissy fit and storm out of his own show back in 1981, when Randi was a guest on the show and criticised the British spiritualist Doris Stokes. So that's who James Randi is. And now, at 81 years old, he's decided to come out as a gay man. Apparently after watching the movie Milk, based on the life of Harvey Milk. And I'm really glad he did, because it must be incredibly difficult at that age to admit something that you've been kind of hiding for pretty much your whole life. I'm sure it's a huge load off his mind. So, Randi, we here at Reality Check, the official worldwide radio show and podcast for LGBT skeptics and friends, are happy to have you now as an official LGBT skeptic. And not only that, but the most famous LGBT skeptic in the world. Congratulations, Randi. And by the way, I should thank our Alert Reality Check listener, Christopher, for posting up a comment on the Reality Check website pretty much the day Randi made his big announcement. So thanks, Christopher, for keeping us well informed. And just as an aside, if you're interested in hearing an interview in which Randi talks about his decision to come out and also reveals that he's been in a relationship with a man for many years now, have a listen to the podcast For Good Reason. That's the podcast, actually, of the James Randi Educational Foundation. And you can find the webpage at forgoodreason.org. And if you download there the March 22nd interview between James Randi and another famous gay skeptic and the presenter of the podcast, DJ Grothy, well, that's the interview where Randi talks about coming out. It's definitely a podcast worth checking out if you get the chance, not just for that interview, but for all the other interesting personalities and skeptical topics they cover. That's forgoodreason.org. Okay, that's it for our marathon LGBT news roundup of the last month or so. Let's listen to a song now, and when we return, we'll begin our analysis of astrology. Do you have some important decisions to make about your life in the near future? Maybe you should buy an astrology magazine and let yourself be guided by the stars. Well, maybe, but then again, maybe not. To find out, stay tuned here on Reality Check on Joy 94.9.
It's pure joy, 94.9.
Cruising for joy? It's safe listening. Joy 94.9.
Welcome back to Reality Check. I'm Tony Pittman and the station is Joy 94.9. And the song you just heard there was Save the Dance, a song from 2005 by none other than Ricky Martin. And of course, I played that song in honour of his momentous coming out on March 29th, exactly 2 weeks ago today. And that song goes out as a special request and dedication to the Melbourne LGBT Latino community. Saludos a todos. Okay, we move now into the part of the show where we undertake a skeptical analysis of a subject related to pseudoscience or the paranormal. And tonight we're going to start to tackle a form of pseudoscience popular the world over, astrology. Now, in the last few episodes of Reality Check, well, at least the last few that I presented, we have been straying a little bit from our primary mission of focusing on skepticism. So I thought that tonight we'd make up for that by examining astrology, which really is one of the staples of the skeptic's diet, one of those core issues that skeptics have to deal with constantly, and one that we haven't really covered on the show until now. So let's begin our discussion with a clarification of terminology by pointing out the difference between astrology and astronomy. Astronomy is the real science. It's the scientific study of celestial objects, that is, stars, planets, comets, galaxies, etc. Basically anything outside the Earth's atmosphere. And it concerns itself with determining the physics, chemistry, history, and motion of those objects, and indeed of the entire universe. Astrology, on the other hand, is a pseudoscience. Like astronomy, it also concerns itself with studying celestial objects, but only their position and motion. It then goes a step further than astronomy and claims that the positions of those celestial objects are somehow correlated with human affairs here on Earth. That's where it cleaves off from astronomy into the realm of pseudoscience. Now, both astronomy and astrology have a common history and a very long history at that, stretching back to prehistoric times, in fact. For thousands of years, there was no distinction between the two fields. People observed the heavens and saw correlations in their lives here on Earth. It was only in about the 16th century, following the Copernican Revolution, and with the observations of Galileo and the use of the telescope for observing the sky, that astronomy started to be seen as a separate field of study from astrology. In fact, it was at that time that the whole scientific revolution itself began. Now, one other preliminary point to make about astrology is that there are many different kinds of astrology. In Australia, people are mostly familiar with the various forms of Western astrology, which themselves arose from Hellenistic and Babylonian astrology. But you also have Chinese astrology and Hindu astrology, which are both very influential in their particular domains. I once went to a wedding, actually, in India that began at 6:13 a.m. precisely, which meant that we, the guests, had to arrive at about 5:30 a.m. Now, why would anyone arrange to have their wedding at such an ungodly hour of the morning? Well, you guessed it, because an astrologer told them that that hour on that day would be the most auspicious time to get married. And this is actually a very common practice in India, where astrology is very influential. And of course, astrology has also changed and evolved through various forms throughout its history. You had Egyptian astrology, Arab and Persian astrology, and there was even a Mayan system of astrology in Central America. And of course, within all those traditions, there are various groups and subgroups, often holding conflicting beliefs. So, an examination of the whole field of astrology in general gets extremely complicated. So that's why today I don't want to get too deeply focused on any particular form of astrology, but rather I thought we'd just have a look at the basic principle that all astrology has in common, that the movements of heavenly bodies affect human affairs here on Earth. Now, to really get a grip on why astrology has been so influential for so long, I think it's useful to try to think about what life was like in those prehistoric times, and to try to put yourself in the shoes of someone living back then. In those days, once the sun went down, there was not much to do other than look up at the stars. And so it was natural that people became extremely familiar with the constellations and other arrangements of heavenly bodies that they saw every single night. There was also no light pollution back then, so the stars would have been a lot more visible than they are for most people nowadays. So those ancient astronomers looking at the stars every night would also have been particularly aware of changes in the arrangement of those tiny dots up there. And although the constellations would have remained fixed night after night, year after year, they would have noticed five dots that were quite clearly not fixed. Five dots that changed their position noticeably over time. These were the five planets that are visible to the naked eye: Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. Compared to the fixed background of stars, it would have been very obvious that these five dots behaved very differently. And apart from those five planets, there were also two other bodies that obviously were not fixed and also moved through the heavens: the sun and the moon. And it's therefore these seven moving objects, the sun, the moon, and the five visible planets, that form the basis of most astrological systems in the world. Now, another helpful way to think about astrology is this. Imagine you're standing right on the equator, looking directly up into the night sky at midnight. So basically, you're looking out into the universe directly away from the sun. You notice the positions of all the constellations. You go back at midnight the next night, and you notice that everything has moved very slightly in one direction. This is because the Earth is orbiting the sun. Every 365.24 days, it completes one orbit. So if you're standing on the equator looking directly up at the sky every midnight for one whole year, you'll notice that gradually you're advancing around the sky. And 6 months after you started, you'll be completely on the opposite side of the sun, and so you'll be seeing a completely different part of the sky with completely different constellations to what you saw 6 months earlier. But 6 months after that, you'll be back to your starting position and seeing the same constellations you began with. Okay, so this gradual 365-day sweep around the whole sky would have been very obvious to prehistoric people. Now, we're not really aware of the changing night sky so much these days, but if you were observing the sky in detail every night for your whole life, it would become a pretty fundamental part of how you understood the world. And this 12-month sweep around the sky forms a fundamental basis of most forms of astrology. For example, the most popular element of Western astrology is what's called sun sign astrology. These are the 12 signs of the zodiac that you see in your daily horoscopes in the newspaper. And I should add, a form of astrology generally looked down upon by serious traditional astrologers. Anyway, each one of those 12 signs of the zodiac corresponds to a constellation in a 30-degree segment of the 360-degree circle, that entire sweep of the sky that you see in one lap of the Earth around the sun. Your sun sign horoscope is based on the position of the sun in relation to those constellations at the time you were born. That is, when looking from the Earth, which constellation was the sun moving across at the time you were born? And it will take the sun about 30 days to move across each constellation of the zodiac. So that's what determines your sun sign. So, contrary to my earlier example where we were looking out into space at midnight, imagine looking in the opposite direction, up at the sun, and being able to see the stars behind it. For example, now in early April, if you could look up at the sun during the day and see the constellations behind it, you'd see that it's the constellation of Aries. But by the end of April, it will have moved into the constellation Taurus. And then by the end of May, it'll be crossing Gemini, and so on and so forth. And then eventually, it'll sweep right across the sky until we come back to seeing it crossing Aries again next April. So this gives you some idea of the basis of pretty much all forms of astrology. They're all about the positions of the seven moving bodies in relation to the fixed constellations. And when you think about it, it wasn't such a crazy idea back in those prehistoric days to think that movements in the heavens might have effects here on Earth. I mean, if people didn't know what those dots in the sky were, and they noticed that some of them moved in irregular ways compared to others, well, it was only natural to try to find a kind of pattern, a kind of correlation with what was happening here on Earth. Especially if they were just tiny dots up there and everything important, everything that mattered, was happening down here on Earth. Then, obviously, the movements of those little dots must mean something. Clearly, they must have some relation to human affairs because, well, everything was related to human affairs. They couldn't just be random events in the sky with no meaning. I mean, really, why would they exist then? What a preposterous notion. Well, yes, a preposterous notion maybe in that time, not so much today. And, in fact, the problem with astrology today is that despite everything we now know about the solar system, the galaxy, and the universe, people still cling onto these beliefs that movements of heavenly bodies somehow affect our lives here on Earth. It seems completely absurd these days, yet could there be something to it? Could the movements of the heavenly bodies really somehow have an influence in your personal life? Well, I'm afraid, dear listener, that because we're running out of time, we're going to have to return to the issue of astrology next week here on Reality Check, and that's when we'll try to answer that question. So, to find out the answer, tune in at 8 o'clock next Monday night here on Joy 94.9. Meanwhile, if you have any questions or comments about astrology or anything else we've covered on the show, or maybe a topic you'd like us to cover, please feel free to send us an email. The address is realitychecktony@gmail.com. You can also visit our website, realitychecconline.net. Okay, let's listen to our final song for today, and when we come back, we'll get into this week's movie review.
All day, all night. Joy 94.9.
Hey, I'm Darren Hayes, and you're on Joy, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station.
Welcome back to Reality Check with me, Tony Pittman, on Joy 94.9. Also streaming live at joy.org.au and also available as a podcast to listen to anywhere in the world on your little pod. And the song you just heard there was Shine by Indonesia's most internationally successful singer, Anggun. And I played that song because Indonesia is officially the flavour of the month here on Reality Check. And because I've just come back from there with a swag full of CDs of the latest Indonesian music, especially to share with you, dear listener. Now, just before we went on the break, we were talking about astrology and we got an SMS from listener Robert in Northcote who says, "Now that Pluto is no longer a planet, astrology has lost a major influencer." That's right, poor Pluto. He was demoted in 2006 down to a dwarf planet. So that's interesting. Now, Pluto was not a visible planet, not visible to the naked eye, so isn't included in traditional astronomy because the people back then couldn't see Pluto. But I feel quite sure there are probably some... Astrology. I'm sure there are some astrologers out there who have probably incorporated Pluto into all their astrological calculations. All right, it's movie review time here on Reality Check, and the two movies up for review this week are both new releases from Europe. One from Sweden, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and one from France, Welcome. So let's start with the Swedish offering. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is based on the best-selling crime novel of the same name by Swedish author Stieg Larsson. It's actually the first novel in a series of three known as the Millennium Trilogy. And all three of the novels have now been made into movies in Sweden, so we can be expecting the sequels, The Girl Who Played with Fire and The Girl Who Kicked the Hornet's Nest, to be released in Australia over the coming months. Now, there's a couple of interesting facts about Stieg Larsson, the author of the novels. Thanks to the international success of his Millennium Trilogy, Stieg Larsson was the second highest best-selling author in the world in 2008, just behind Khaled Hosseini, the author of The Kite Runner. His trilogy to date has sold 27 million copies in over 40 countries. And the ironic and tragic twist in this story is that this massive international literary success came too late for Stieg Larsson to enjoy. He died in 2004 and all his novels were published posthumously. So that's the background to the first movie we'll be reviewing tonight. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo tells the story of Mikael Blomkvist, an investigative journalist working in Stockholm, who is hired by the elderly and somewhat mysterious Henrik Wanger, the head of the extremely wealthy Wanger dynasty and the Wanger group of companies. Mikhail's mission is to use his investigative skills to solve a presumed murder, the disappearance of Henrik Wanger's 16-year-old niece some 40 years earlier. Mikhail begins his investigation and by chance meets up with Lisbeth, a young, emotionally disturbed, punk-style, goth-style, computer-hacker, cyber-chick who happens to be the girl with the dragon tattoo from the title. She helps Mikhail to follow the clues to finally solve the 40-year-old disappearance. Now, I don't know what the novel is like. By all accounts, it would appear to be pretty good. Unfortunately, though, I can't say the same for the movie. It was, for me, quite a disappointment. If I didn't know it was based on the book, I would have thought that the director just grabbed any old script from one of those charming British murder mystery TV series. You know, one of those village shows, as my friend Nick in England calls them. Something along the lines of Midsummer Murders, or Inspector Morse, or even Miss Marple. There's a mysterious disappearance in the village, and a detective comes along and starts finding clues, and gradually gets closer and closer to the killer, until suddenly our hero finds themselves in real danger. But then at the last minute they somehow manage to escape and reveal the identity of the killer to everyone, all in time for a cup of tea and scones down at the local parish hall. And that works perfectly well for an hour of television, if you're into that sort of thing. But then it seems like the director had this TV script and said, well, we need to make this into a movie for the cinema, so why don't we add some hot young chick and make her an emotionally disturbed bisexual and add some completely gratuitous scenes of heavy sexualized violence. You know, some really nasty rape and revenge type stuff. And, well, the fact that it doesn't have anything at all to do with the rest of the story, well, that's by the by. I'm sure no one will notice. The audience just wants to see sex and violence and see the murder mystery resolved with a happy ending, and voila, we've got ourselves a hit movie. Now, I know it didn't happen that way because the plot comes straight out of the book, but it sure feels like that's how it was put together. The film never rises above an episode of some generic murder mystery TV series. And what makes it worse is those very nasty and pointless violent rape scenes in the first 45 minutes of the film, which have nothing to do with the rest of the story. I guess they were included because they were in the book, but they don't really add anything to the movie. And at over 2.5 hours, this movie is way too long. Those pointless rape scenes just make it even longer for no good reason. Strangely, though, this movie is getting great reviews pretty much everywhere. Rotten Tomatoes is currently giving it a rating of 83%. But I have to say, I'm perplexed as to why. Unless all those reviewers had read the books and so appreciated something about the film that I didn't get. In my opinion, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo doesn't deserve all the hype it's getting and is definitely a movie you can easily afford to miss. Which is definitely not what I would say about our second film up for review this evening, the French film Welcome. Whereas The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is pure frivolous entertainment, and not even good entertainment at that, Welcome is a compelling and well-made film with a lot to say about one of the most pressing issues of our time, illegal immigration. In fact, Welcome was shown in both the French and the European parliaments in an effort to get the immigration law in France amended. Welcome is set in the French port city of Calais, the closest city to England, just 34 kilometres from Dover, in fact. And the story focuses on the friendship that develops between a 17-year-old Iraqi Kurd, Bilal, and a middle-aged French swimming coach, Simone. Bilal is in Calais along with hundreds of other illegal immigrants trying to find a way to sneak across the English Channel to be reunited with his girlfriend who lives in London. His first attempt to cross, a harrowing experience that involves hiding inside a truck with a plastic bag over his head, fails. And so he gets the idea of swimming across the channel to get to England. So he starts to take swimming lessons, and that's how he meets Simone. Simon soon works out what Bilal is planning and initially tries to discourage him. But when he sees that it's hopeless, he tries to help Bilal as much as he can. Now, Welcome is a small film and a simple story, and at times a little bit slow, yet it packs a pretty hefty punch. First, because the story is emotionally very involving, thanks to the great performances, particularly from the first-time actor who plays Bilal, Firat Ayverdi, who I have to say is a total boy babe, and I will definitely be watching out for what he does in the future. But the other reason the movie has such an impact is because it really gives a very illuminating insight into the injustices and difficulties faced not only by illegal immigrants in France these days, but also by French citizens who try to help them. The immigrants struggle constantly to find food and get shelter. They are also prevented from entering supermarkets and even from paying to have showers at the local swimming pool. And the local population is powerless to help them. This is really the revelation of the movie, the demonstration of how France's tough immigration law works in practice, a law that makes it a crime for a French citizen to offer any assistance to an illegal immigrant. This includes offering them food, giving them a ride, or letting them stay in your house. The movie shows how unjust and inhuman this law really is. In scenes which are more reminiscent of Nazi Germany than modern-day France, a culture of spying and denunciation is created as French citizens report anonymously on their neighbours, who are then hauled off to the police because someone saw them offer a ride to a presumed illegal immigrant, or a neighbour suspects them of letting an immigrant sleep the night in their home. It's really shocking to see. And that's why I reckon that Welcome does something that films about social issues really should do, and does it well. It takes an abstract or technical law and personalizes it. It shows you the unjust effects that this law has on real human beings. And in my opinion, that's what makes Welcome such a powerful film, and one definitely worth checking out if you get the chance. And that brings us to the end of the 32nd episode of Reality Check on Joy 94.9. I hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to send any questions, comments, or feedback to realitychecktony@gmail.com and visit our website at realitycheckonline.net. And remember to tune in at 8 o'clock next Monday for episode 33. Coming up next, Cade presents An Awkward Pause. Have a great week, everyone. See you next week.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.